The gospel lesson for the first Sunday of Christmas is from the Gospel of Matthew, the second chapter. And what I've done is I've put together that first Sunday of Christmas passage with the Epiphany passage. So Epiphany is January 6th, which is what, Friday, I think? So I've kind of mushed them together. So it's kind of a long reading, so bear with me. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, asking, "Where is the child who has been born King of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, 'And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.'" Then Herod secretly called for the wise men, and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child. And when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage." When they had heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. Now, after they had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the Magi. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled: "He will be called a Nazarene." Heaven and earth will pass away, but the word of the Lord is forever. Thanks be to God. So the lectionary is a structured way of marching through the Bible each Sunday. Now, some preachers like Bob Morrison don't like using the lectionary, in part because it leaves stuff out. But I figure once I have preached on every passage that's in the lectionary, then I'll start looking elsewhere in the Bible. But for now, I'm going to stick with it. The lectionary is a 3-year cycle. The Gospel of John is sprinkled throughout all 3 years, But each year is primarily organized around one of the synoptic gospels. Year A for Matthew, year B for Mark, year C for Luke. The year starts with Advent, so we're just over a month into year A. I thought I'd take this opportunity to give you a thumbnail sketch of Matthew, since we'll be in it all year. The reason we have four gospels is that they each have a different theme and a different main perspective, a different main teaching. The theme of Matthew is that Jesus is like Moses and is leading his people to freedom. The Torah, or Pentateuch, is the first five books of what we call the Old Testament: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. There's a story arc to the Torah that starts with one man, Adam, whose descendants include Jacob, renamed Israel. Jacob and his 12 sons move to Egypt during a famine and are the fathers of 12 tribes. Their relationship with Pharaoh degenerates into slavery, so that Moses is raised up to lead the Israelites to freedom in the promised land of Canaan. Along the way, God enters into a covenant relationship with Israel, encapsulated in the Ten Commandments, and also gives them the law to help them fulfill their end of the covenant. They struggle to follow God's commands, particularly the prohibition against idolatry, so they're forced to wander in the desert for 40 years. Even Moses is not allowed to enter Canaan, but then the next generation is blessed and told to enter the promised land. So Matthew is structured to evoke this same story arc. The parallels are not exact, but there's enough pieces to remind readers of that origin story. So the gospel is oriented around five discourses, which are meant to mirror the five books of the Torah. It starts with a genealogy that situates Jesus in Israel's history. The discourses include law-like teachings, particularly the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus institutes the Lord's Supper, which we'll be celebrating today, he calls it a new covenant, which is like an extension of that original covenant. Then the very end of the gospel is the Great Commission, saying to go into all the world. So here we are at the beginning, and Matthew is trying to establish those parallels. Now, I'm not saying that Matthew fabricated anything, but he chose story elements that would portray Jesus in a certain way, that would highlight his role as the new Moses. The first aspect he tries to evoke is the sense that he's under threat and always on the move. So the book of Genesis is a travelogue of sorts that tells a story of Abraham's travels, and then his son Isaac's travels, and then his son Jacob's travels, and then the grand story of his son Joseph going to Egypt and asking all of his brothers to join him there, and then, of course, the exodus out of Egypt over to Canaan. In the same way, we see the Holy Family, Joseph. Remember, Joseph was the one that took them to Egypt, took the Israelites to Egypt. So we see Joseph, Mary, and Jesus under threat and on the move. They're in Bethlehem in Judea, but Joseph has a dream, just like the Joseph in Genesis, and is told that they have to leave Bethlehem and sojourn in Egypt. When the threat's removed, they return to what was Israel, but they can't quite go home. There's still some danger, so they go to Nazareth instead of Bethlehem. So when Jesus shows up, everything changes, and everyone's lives are upended. So think about poor Mary, pregnant, but not yet married. And then poor Joseph is betrothed to a woman who becomes pregnant, but apparently with another man's child. An angel tells him to go through with the marriage anyway, which probably leaves a cloud hanging over the family their whole lives. And not only does Joseph need to marry this pregnant woman, but he also needs to flee to Egypt and then move to a different town. Nothing in his life will ever be the same. In the same way, Jesus commands that we follow him, knowing that our lives will never be the same, that we will live under threat from the world around us. Now, in that time and place, the major threat against Jesus and his ministry that became Christianity was from the Roman Empire and its client kings and princes, which was Herod and his sons, in addition to the religious power structures. So when Jesus was born, he was destined to die just like all people. But he was particularly destined to die young because he posed a threat to the people who benefited from the structures of society as it was. Rulers who liked to rule, religious authorities who liked their place of authority, and so forth. Anyone who threatens the structure of society can expect to run into problems in their lives. The church, church with a capital C, is Christ's body in the world and is still under threat today. In some parts of the world, there are physical threats. So I just finished an audiobook by David Platt that's set in the Himalayas. The local Hindus and Buddhists see Christianity as teaching foreign gods that will anger their local gods. And really, the stories that he tells really evoke a lot of the Bible stories about, you know, teaching these foreign gods and angering the local gods. He tells a story about local leaders burning down the house and worship structure that belonged to a couple of Christian missionaries. He tells another story of tribal leaders literally stoning a Christian couple to death. Here in America, though, the major threat against the church is more mundane: irrelevance. So I don't need to cite a bunch of statistics for you to realize that church attendance and membership are in decline. They've been in decline since the 60s. And some individual churches are doing fine, but the broad trend in all denominations is downward. Why? Well, there's lots of reasons, but I think the pandemic revealed the utter irrelevance of the church to many people, the majority of people. When things shut down in 2020, a lot of church leaders protested and insisted on continuing to meet. Why? Well, they said it was because that was essential to their worship of God, but I think they were really afraid that people would realize that they don't need to attend worship. People who had already been just kind of going through the motions would realize they can find spiritual connections and human community without their churches. Even among those gathered here today, I'm guessing that most find community in places other than just the church, whether that's, you know, clubs or sororities, service and professional organizations, political parties and activist groups, and so forth. And I mean, I count myself as one of those, and I find community in all of those kinds of places. Churches are also assailed for their hypocrisy. So I want to be clear that I'm not speaking specifically about First Presbyterian Church of Rolla, but churches generally. And from the outside, a lot of people outside the church see Christianity as this monolith, right? Now, we know that it's not, right? But from an outsider's perspective, they see us as places where we congratulate ourselves for being such good people without actually having an impact on the community. So during the cold snap right before Christmas, I saw a post on Facebook lamenting the fact that churches weren't opening their doors to the homeless and to those who were in places with inadequate heat. So, saw that post, and my first reaction was, well, we support the mission, right? And the mission provides that service. Great. And in fact, some of us actually volunteer at the mission. My second reaction was, you know, we have our own struggles, and we don't have the people or the systems in place to provide that kind of ministry, even for one night. So, I mean, there's reasons that we didn't do that, but the more I think about it, the more I think, you know, there is that criticism is valid. It's just one symptom of a broader disengagement from the problems of the world. We talk about them and give money to support organizations that help people. And many of us are part of those organizations, right? I look out and I see a lot of people who I know volunteer at the Mission or at Grace or at the food bank or lots of places in town. But is that enough? It's not enough for the unchurched people in Rolla to see us as reflections of the light of the world. So as I said, the gospel according to Matthew is full of Jesus' teachings of a new law. So we're in chapter 2. Next week will be chapter 3, which is the baptism of Jesus. And then in chapter 5, we have the Sermon on the Mount, which is the first of 5 discourses and the most explicit set of teachings, where he tells his followers to be salt and light for the world. He expands on Moses' teachings and moves the locus of the law from external to internal. Not only should people not murder, but they also shouldn't be angry. He says that they should love their neighbor and also that they should love their enemies. He says many other things and then says, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on rock." We are to be not just hearers, but also doers. The fifth and last discourse ends in Matthew 25. In it, he says that he will sit on the throne of his glory and judge the nations. He will separate the nations between those who cared for the hungry, the stranger, the naked, the sick, and the prisoner, and those nations that did not. Throughout the gospel, Jesus teaches that we are supposed to care for one another, not just individually, but as a community and society and world. He commands us to transform the world. He is concerned not with personal salvation, or not only with personal salvation, but with the salvation of all people. So the task before us in this new year is to be doers of the word, not just hearers. So I want to return to that story about the missionaries in the Himalayas. So this couple moved to a little village, and they built a house and then a separate structure that you use for worship and ministry. They helped the villagers in their daily lives while also teaching about Jesus. Then one night, a group of militants knocked on their door with guns and torches. The leader pointed a gun at them and said that they needed to leave the village and never return. Once the couple was out of the building, they torched them and burnt both structures to the ground. So the couple moved on, but they stayed in touch with the people who had converted to Christianity while they were there. Sometime later, there was a natural disaster that destroyed many homes in that village. When the missionary couple heard, they gathered up all the people they could and returned to the village to help rebuild. Even though their lives had been threatened and their possessions destroyed, they returned. They continued to love their enemies. Afterwards, the leader of the militants, who had been the conduit for so much hate directed at them, felt the love of Christ through the missionaries and converted to Christianity. He donated land for them to rebuild a worship and ministry center. He himself became an outcast and subject to hatred from his former fellow militants, but God's love was stronger than their hate. That's what it means to follow Jesus' teachings. That's what it means to love your enemies. If you believe that Jesus loves you, shouldn't you share that love with others? We're not saved by our works, but we're saved for works. Jesus loves and redeems us into God's family so that we can serve others and bring them into God's family. The church is now and has always been countercultural. In first century Judea, that meant conflict with the Roman Empire, King Herod, and Herod's sons. That meant conflict with the religious authorities who benefited from collusion with those secular rulers. That meant death on a cross for Jesus, death by stoning for Stephen, persecution and jail and floggings and executions for many other followers of the way. Today, being countercultural means taking care of each other in an every man for himself world. It means teaching love instead of judgment. It means seeking out the people who others consider to be problems, to be ignored or eliminated, and trying to bring them into community. It means working for a world in which all people are valued and know the love of God in their lives. And in so doing, we will enter the promised land, a transformed world where God lives and reigns forever. Amen.